The television hit The Office is populated with types, albeit exaggerated ones, types you'd find in the workplace. There's been the inappropriate boss, Michael Scott, the power-hungry misfit, Dwight Schrute, and the perpetual teenager, Kelly Kapoor. She's a boy-crazy shopaholic, frivolous, and celebrity-obsessed. She also happens to be Indian-American.
I bet you get pulled over by the cops a lot just because of your race.
Well, they say it's because of texting, but maybe you're right.
I think you should consider applying for the Executive Minority Training Program.
Never thought of myself as an executive before.
I know, because you have no role models. How many Indian CEOs can you think of?
I can't think of any CEOs, any race.
You could be the Indian Bill Gates.
I could be the Indian Julia Roberts.
That's not... She's... Okay.
Mindy Kaling is the actress who brings Kelly to life on The Office, where she's also a writer and executive producer, and now add the title author of a book of essays about her life called Is Everyone Hanging Out Without Me? Now, she may be a fashion-conscious Hollywood type these days, but the back cover of her book shows the child Mindy, thick glasses, ill-fitting sweater, and hair cropped into a bowl cut.
I can't believe how little effort my parents put into making me seem like an appealing little girl. I mean, I feel like you sometimes hear celebrities, they'll show photos of themselves, and they're like, I can't believe how unattractive I was. And when you really were not a very attractive kid, you really want to be like, oh, no, I was the real deal. See this photo.
You do write about high school and not being very popular in high school, but the way you write about it is not to worry. The last thing what anyone needs is to have high school as the high point of your life.
You know, that's one of those things where I wrote that, and even if I had heard that as a 15-year-old, that don't worry about being popular in high school, even I know that that might be just completely futile advice. I mean, I was obsessed with being popular when I was in high school, and I never achieved it. There's photos from our high school musicals and things, and I'm comically in the deep background wearing a beggar's costume. There are musicals, I didn't even know there were beggars, and I managed to play them. I played a street urchin in Evita. In City of Angels, I played a Los Angeles hobo. Like, whatever they could find, the sort of desperate-looking urchin in a musical, our drama teacher managed to find a part for me playing it.
Well, you discovered you were funny, and you discovered you had a lot of appeal when you hit college. You know, it seemed like you blossomed.
I felt incredibly special in college. I was really lucky. I mean, I went to Dartmouth College, so simply by being an Indian American woman, I was already so statistically interesting. And then the fact that I didn't want to do anything science related and I wanted to write comedy plays and act a little bit. I mean, I became deeply interesting at college because of how rare that was.
Another rarity Mindy Kaling writes about, being average-sized in stick-skinny Hollywood. Here she reads an excerpt from the book.
Since I am not model skinny, but also not super fat and fabulously owning my hugeness, I fall into that nebulous, quote-unquote, normal American woman size that legions of fashion stylists detest. For the record, I'm a size 8, this week anyway. Many stylists hate that size because I think to them it shows that I lack the discipline to be an ascetic or the confident sassy abandon to be a total fatty hedonist. They're like, pick a lane. Just be so enormous that you need to be buried in a piano and dress accordingly.
This is the sort of reality that Kaling mines, as when Kelly Kapoor experiments with crazy fad diets.
We always think of I was on a diet with a big groan, but I think diets are fun. I think it is an American pastime for a lot of women. I don't know. I think that Kelly thinks of dieting as a fun hobby to have.
Well, there is one moment in one of the episodes where Kelly is concocting. It's this terrible diet. It's hot sauce and grapefruit juice.
This is real. This is the...
It's a real diet. Yeah,
it's a real diet, which Beyonce Knowles famously went on to lose weight for Dreamgirls. Kelly heard it, and then she tried the diet, did it for, 4 days, and then fainted, I think, at work.
You're shaking. Are you all right?
Just leave me alone!
I am on the third day of my cleanse diet. All I have to do is drink maple syrup, lemon juice, cayenne pepper, and water for all three meals. I just bought some bikinis online, size 2, so I look amazing.
And you, Kelly, look like a zombie. It's like...
Yes, I do look like someone from The Walking Dead. That's pretty well observed. If you've ever done a diet like that, an incredibly restrictive diet, which I'm embarrassed to say I have tried for very short periods of time, you do become, your personality does change into that kind of Walking Dead personality.
You know, you're known, obviously, as a character on The Office, which has a cult following, practically. But you have a lot of followers on Twitter. We're talking, what, a couple of million?
I think right now I have 1.5 million.
Oh, only a million and a half. Right? Well, sorry.
Whenever you brag about how many Twitter followers you have, like, I think Kim Kardashian has close to 10 million. And Lady Gaga has more than some huge nations. So I sort of pale in comparison to that.
Can you stop micromanaging? I know how to do this.
Okay.
You're yelling.
What are you guys doing?
This girl was really rude to me at the mall. So I created a fake IM account from a hot guy at our high school, and now I'm trying to make her anorexic.
Tell her everyone in the homeroom thinks she's fat.
Oh, that is so good.
Mindy Kaling as Kelly Kapoor. She's also a writer and producer for The Office. And her collection of essays is called Is Everyone Hanging Out Without Me?
Here are some truths that are not entirely self-evident. On September 18th, 2012, the people of Madison, Wisconsin will take a vow of no cannibalism. It will last 7 days. In Korea, it is common to give glass figurines, especially figurines of Vincent D'Onofrio, the Koreans' favorite actor. And when SCUBA does not stand for Self-Contained Underwater Breathing American, it stands for Southern Cuba Uncommunist Business Association. How do I know these strange facts, so unsettling to conventional wisdom, and in fact so completely bogus? I have read them all in John Hodgman's new book, the third and logically the final book in his trilogy of encyclopedic wisdom. The title is That Is All. John Hodgman, welcome back to the program.
Thank you very much. Nice to speak with you, my old nemesis.
And I should remind listeners that in addition to appearing on The Daily Show with Jon Stewart as a general expert on just about everything, you were also the person in a long-running but now long-gone series of Apple commercials in which you played the competition, the personal computer. I gather this was a life-changing experience for you.
It was indeed. People would come up to me and say, hey, personal computer, will you print out this document for me? They would say, hey, will you correct the red eye in this photograph of me? And they don't ask me to do that anymore, even though I'm really good at it.
What has it been like to fall back to earth from this pinnacle of fame you enjoyed?
Well, it's a mournful experience, quite honestly. I mean, those ads were not only a lot of fun for me to make, but also it marked a huge transformation in my life from basically magazine writer and literary humorist, you know, your basic nobody, to a very famous minor television personality. And then, and while I understand that all things must come to an end, whether it's a television advertisement or one's life or the world itself, it doesn't make it any easier to deal with our own mortality.
Speaking of the end of the world itself, your book, That Is All, it's a very unusual book. It begins on page 607 because the trilogy, I gather, is a single work.
Yes.
It is amply footnoted, and it also includes at the top of each page a day-by-day calendar entry for the coming year that breathes a vivid, detailed life into the Mayan forecast of the end of time.
Well, as you know, this is the year 2011, and if you own a calendar, you'll know that it's just one scant year before 2012. And if you own a Mayan long count calendar, then I suspect your home is very large because those things are big and made of stone. And of course, the Mayans stopped making calendars because they thought 2012 was going to be the end of the world. And due to some visions that I had at night under the influence of my albuterol asthma inhaler, I saw some difficult things coming down the line.
I think difficult things is an understatement. Giant toads, mole men heading to the center of the earth.
Yes. You speak of the century toad that exists at the center of the earth. And, of course, the return of the ancient unspeakable ones, like H.P. Lovecraft predicted. There's the blood wave, the omega pulse, and also the collapse of the American book publishing industry.
I don't mean to make
light
of that.
Which for some people is truly the end of the world, especially those of us who only have books to write.
Yes. You in this book, just as in the first in the trilogy, The Areas of My Expertise, I believe you had 500 hobo names.
700. Actually. Please don't understate.
I'm sorry. I don't mean to deny you credit.
My writing of 700 ridiculous hobo nicknames.
And now you have hundreds of names of the unspeakable ones.
700 ancient and unspeakable gods. The ancient gods who are known for their wrath, their cosmic indifference to humanity, their tentacles, and who will soon return to the earth and make it their plaything once more.
One of the dimensions of this coming apocalypse is what you write about is the jock-nerd convergence.
Oh, this is very disturbing, isn't it?
Yes.
The fight between jock culture and nerd culture is the culture war of our time. I mean, that really, I think almost everything in life can be divided into whether it represents a jockish view of the world, which is to say authoritarian, top-down, privileging gut instinct over rumination and the hatred of anyone who uses the word rumination. and the nerd point of view, which is obsessive enthusiasm for increasingly marginal niche cultures and subcultures and a kind of joyful utopian anarchy. And yet there is so much overlap that's happening now. Now, superhero movies are apparently the only movies that are made. I read of an actual baseball player who has named his baseball bat after after Orcrist, which is one of the elven blades in The Hobbit.
Among many other surprising facts in your book, such as how Harry Houdini escaped from a can of sardines and how the sardines were made. Yeah, trapdoor.
Spoiler alert, trapdoor.
The sardines cooperated, though, with this
Much as sardines can. They were drugged.
You also offer some useful tips on traveling around the world, which I gather that you've come by in your recent career as a deranged millionaire.
Yes. Well, now that my commercials are over, presumably because we sold all the computers, I lead a simpler life of a humble, deranged millionaire, and I've traveled all over the world to, gosh, I would say 3 continents, at least 4 provinces of Canada, most of the United States, and on cruise ships. And this is the most fascinating thing, because a cruise ship is like a fantastic floating city, and when the blood wave comes, you'll want to be on one.
When the blood wave comes, yes, rather than being on land, you're saying.
Oh, yes, I would say either when the seas rise or the blood wave comes, you will want to be on one of these gigantic cruise ships. It's one of the ways that you can survive for just a few days longer. But let me tell you, traveling on the sea, there's a lot of superstition around it. Mm-hmm. Did you know that?
I do now after reading your book, but you should share with the listeners.
Yes, I was setting myself up for that one, if you don't mind. Yes. Did you know that a woman on board is considered to be bad luck? And that's why, obviously,
a lot of bad luck in the world.
Yeah, we let women on board cruise ships, but they are asked to wear special rayon underwear because it is believed that vengeful Poseidon can't see through rayon. So, and dolphins swimming alongside a ship's bow are considered good luck. So when you're on a cruise ship, please don't free the dolphins that have been lashed to the front of the ship, even if it seems they're just being dragged along. It may look like they're suffering, but they're just lazy. Dolphins are incredibly lazy, as you know.
Well, now we know. And yes. You've made sailing that much more user-friendly, I guess, to use it.
Yes, and I wish to emphasize that while my book does deal with the coming global superpocalypse known as Ragnarok, it's not depressing. And indeed, there's much, much more in this book about travel and sports and wine and magic tricks and ghosts and anything that might distract a casual reader from the fact that they are mortal, which is everyone.
Well, John Hodgman, thank you very much for talking with us.
I could be wrong. I could be wrong, you know.
Let's hope.
It may be that the world will not end on December 21st, 2012.
Okay.
In which case, you can buy the paperback.
John Hodgman's book is called That Is All. Is it really the last of your encyclopedic works? Or?
It certainly is the last of my books of complete world knowledge. This is final world knowledge, at last finally complete.
Are you saying you're now going to get speculative?
I think I'm going to take a rest.
For the second time, the writer Joan Didion has shared with the readers the story of a loved one she outlived. Didion won praise for The Year of Magical Thinking, her book about the death of her husband, John Gregory Dunn. By the time that book was published in 2005, Didion had suffered another loss, her daughter Quintana Roo, their only child, dead at age 39. Now, Joan Didion has written about that death in her book Blue Nights. Didion has faced some difficult questions, first in life, then in print, and now in this interview with NPR special correspondent Susan Stamberg.
Well, look, Joan Didion, you can write, and you've done that, about the death of your daughter. But can you talk about it? And if you can, how do you get yourself to do it?
I think maybe it has not left my mind since it happened, and so I live with it. So naturally, I can talk about it. After a while, I mean, I couldn't talk about it at first, but I can now.
But clearly talk does not come easily, nor, she says, did the writing of Blue Nights. That's harder for her now, more groping for words, less polishing. Her prose in the past just gleamed. It was so terse, elegant, understated, and piercing. The new book is what's left after loss. And, you know, the question that occurs to all of us, and forgive me, I'm asking you the toughest questions first, is how you survive the loss of the two people you love most in this world, your husband, and then very quickly after, your daughter.
Well, we all survive more than we think we can, don't you think? I mean, we imagine things that we will be unable to survive, and in fact, we do survive them.
You think we just have no choice? I mean, what else?
We have no
do,
choice,
right?
So we do it.
Yeah, you can't crawl into a corner in the closet and stay there forever.
Well, you can try. I certainly felt like it.
John Gregory Dunn died of a massive heart attack. Quintana Roo Dunn died of complications from a flu that turned into pneumonia, then septic shock, an induced coma, a brain bleed, 5 surgeries, months in intensive care, a medical and emotional nightmare. Most of Joan Didion's books contain little mantras, quick phrases repeated at various times throughout the text. In Blue Nights, it's this: when we talk about mortality, we're talking about our children. She means the responsibility we feel for them, our fear that harm will come to them from a swimming pool, an automatic elevator, a bottle of Drano under the sink, that we can't protect them well enough. For Didion, the apprehensions arrived gradually. Just after they adopted Quintana Roo, they had seen that name on a map of Mexico, liked it, chose it. The writer says she acted as if she'd gotten a doll, not a real baby, something to dress up.
We had many dresses. We had 66 dresses that she got for christening presents.
Sounds like your friends were as clueless as you.
Yeah, everybody was clueless. Everybody to do with this angel baby had no clue.
But they were so delighted, as you
yes.
were, to have her, huh?
Yes.
In a while, the realities of baby and child-rearing set in, and the new mother dealt, in part because, as Didion writes, Quintana had no idea how much we needed her.
I needed her in the sense that she was simply the center of my life. And I needed someone to take care of.
So a place to put your feelings, your focus, your more than your writing.
I needed to put it in my writing, but I also needed to put it in this person who was actually in the house.
Quintana Roo Dunn was an affectionate child, bright, funny. She posted a list of mom's sayings in their garage in Malibu.
Brush your teeth, brush your hair, shush, I'm working. She and a friend in the neighborhood each posted their mom's sayings in the garage.
Were you a nag or just an ordinary?
No, I was a nag who was totally wrapped up in keeping some time free for myself, obviously.
Quintana Roo Dunn was, Didion writes, a quicksilver child, moody. The moods shifted rapidly. Eventually, there was a diagnosis, borderline personality disorder. Didion neither understood nor accepted that diagnosis. Blue Nights begins in Manhattan with Quintana's wedding day, July 26th, 2003. It was a happy day.
She wanted to have lays instead of bouquets.
Because she'd spent enough time in Hawaii.
Because she'd spent so much time in Hawaii.
Mm-hmm.
She wanted to wear her hair in a braid down her back. She'd worn it that way as a child. When we lived at the beach, she wanted to have cucumber and watercress sandwiches. Everything about her wedding had to represent her past.
It's lovely. It's as if she pulled together her very best memories
mm-hmm.
for that one special day.
For that one day.
Memories now for Joan Didion are stored in boxes, in drawers, closets, the things she saved.
I saved dresses I bought for her when she was 4 or 5. Well, I remember it particularly because it's still hanging in her closet. a black challis, wool challis dress with roses on it that I bought at Bendel's. Hmm.
Can you open that closet door?
I open that closet door all the time now, yeah.
Mm-hmm. But what you write is, in theory, these mementos serve to bring back the moment. In fact, they serve only to make clear how inadequately I appreciated the moment when it was here.
Yes, exactly.
The business of public reaction, I find, too, having lost my husband, people don't know what to say to you. And what they will say, and they're trying it just in good nature and trying to be sympathetic and positive, they will say, well, you have your memories.
You have your wonderful memories. Yes. Yes. Exactly. I don't know how to me.
Have you found the best answer to that?
No, I haven't. I've never found any. Did you find one?
No, I say yes.
Did you find one?
No, I say yes, I do.
That's what I say.
It's hard, but good to laugh. Good to get her to laugh. Good to get her to laugh. It's a way to move through harrowing times, unimaginable losses. And right, Joan Didion's new book is called Blue Nights. I'm Susan Stamberg, NPR News.
Our book today comes from writer and comedian Andy Borowitz. He's a regular contributor to The New Yorker, and he's been called one of the funniest people in America. His new book is an anthology of the 50 funniest American writers. It's already a New York Times bestseller, but it's an unlikely collaboration, Borowitz says, with the Library of America.
Somehow in this process, I've convinced one of the most prestigious publishing companies in the country to produce a bathroom book.
That was your pitch. You were like, let's do a bathroom book. I mean, this was your ambition.
It was.
But bathroom books are like the 500 greatest golf jokes or or like great facts about sports.
Exactly. You know, comedy, I think, is not the realm of snobbery. I think comedy is whatever makes you laugh.
Borowitz has made a career out of being funny, but he initially got into comedy for one simple reason. Girls.
That is how everyone gets into comedy. Because if you are having sex in high school, then you have better things to do than to read prose comedy on Saturday nights. So it's true. I was a typical awkward, geeky, nerdy teenager, and I was under the impression that the way to appeal to women was by being funny. And the reason I came to that conclusion was that I had read the Playboy data sheet that accompanied Playboy centerfolds, where the playmates sort of unburden themselves and tell the reader what are the things that are their turn-ons and turn-offs. And turn-ons, without fail, always included a sense of humor.
So it wasn't not a successful strategy at the time.
No. You know, in high school, girls may say that they want the guy who makes them laugh, but inevitably they want the guy who gives wedgies to the guy who makes them laugh. They don't really go for the jester so much, the class clown. It takes a while for guys who are funny or who are comedians to actually get girls. I think that happens much later. Mm-hmm. But it's good because all of that disappointment is what kind of makes us funny and gives us material.
So this anthology, The 50 Funniest American Writers, the first story is my favorite story.
Really?
It's Mark Twain's a piece called A Presidential Candidate. Tell me about this story. Why'd you pick it?
Well, what's shocking about this piece is how modern it is. I mean, this is like something that could have been written yesterday.
Yeah.
And that's what's infuriating about Mark Twain as a comedy writer, which is that he did everything I'm trying to do 100 years
ago. He's ruined it better for everybody else.
Now, we're just going through our paces compared to Mark Twain. It's sort of a monologue, and he says that he's decided to run for president, and he knows that the press is going to dredge up every bad skeleton in his closet. So he's going to get all the bad news out himself. And so he starts talking about how he chased a rheumatic grandfather up a tree and killed him by giving him a heart attack. And that's how he opens. And then it really just gets worse from there. And you read this and you think, if only candidates would do this now, if only we were spared the indignity of watching Mark Sanford talk about how he wasn't really on the Appalachian Trail. But that's what's sort of awesome about starting the anthology with Mark Twain, because this thing really could have been written yesterday.
He writes, "The rumor that I buried a dead ant under my grapevine was correct. Was correct. The vine needed fertilizing. My aunt had to be buried."
That's Mark Twain. Yeah, it's a great sort of opening act for the book.
So I was surprised to see Sinclair Lewis on this list, because I thought he was a serious guy.
Yeah, well, he was. He also wrote a really funny book, satirical book called Babbitt. It's just a great satire of Midwestern middle-class conformity. He takes Babbitt through his lunch hour where he goes to his club in his Midwestern town. And it's just really a little comic masterpiece. I'm hoping that some of the more serious writers that we think of as serious writers who are in this book will maybe take a look at in a different way now, because we say, wait a minute, you know, Sinclair Lewis could be funny when he wanted to be.
There's an essay by John Hughes, who is, of course, the famous director known for, you know, doing The Breakfast Club and
Home Alone.
Home Alone. He did Home Alone.
Ferris Bueller's Day Off.
Yes. He has an essay in here called Vacation 58. Mm-hmm. I had never heard of this story before. How did you come across it?
This is, I think, the one piece in the book that I'd have to say really justifies the entire purchase price of the book. If you buy it for no other reason. John Hughes started his career as an advertising copywriter, hated the job, and he wanted to get into comedy writing desperately. He basically camped out at the National Lampoon offices in New York and submitted stories to them. And the first one they published was this vacation piece, and it's a very surreal story of the all-American family vacation that goes awry. Now, this later, of course, became the Chevy Chase vacation movies, and it led to his amazing run of successful comedy movies. What I love about the fact that this is in the book is that this has never been published since the 70s when it appeared in National Lampoon. And it's very cool for me as an anthologist to be able to unearth something like this and share it with an audience that would never otherwise see it.
The first name of the dad in this story is Clark, of course, played by Chevy Chase in the vacation movies. The first line of this story is, "If Dad hadn't shot Walt Disney in the leg, it would have been our best vacation ever." I'm speaking with Andy Borowitz. He's the editor of the new anthology, The 50 Funniest American Writers. There's a story in here by Molly Ivins, the late Molly Ivins, one of the best-known humorists of her generation. It's called Tough as Bob Wore and Other Stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Tell me about that story.
Well, this is vintage Molly Ivins. Molly Ivins, a great old dame of Texas who wrote about Texas politics the way no one else did. And she really kind of came into her own towards the end of her life, because she finally had a topic that was of national interest or concern, which was the presidency of George W. Bush. So she had a lot to write about there. But there's a great quote from Molly Ivins, which I like to pass on, which she said, "The next time I tell you that somebody from Texas should not be president of the United States, will you please listen?" And as true today, I think, as it was when she said it.
Andy, you a lot of people listening know you from The New Yorker or they'll go on the Borowitz Report online. But I actually had no idea, and I think I'm going to shock a lot of people, you actually created the Fresh Prince of Bel-Air.
That is true.
That's true. That was you.
That was me. That was me 20 years ago. I actually followed the path that was sort of the opposite of what most of the Algonquin Round Table did. They spent years writing for The New Yorker and then went out to Hollywood in their 40s and 50s and tried to make a quick buck. I got out of college and immediately tried to make a quick buck. And I wrote for TV and wrote for a lot of sitcoms. I started writing on the Norman Lear shows, Archie Bunker's Place and things like that. And in 1990, NBC signed me to create a show for Will Smith. And I had never heard of Will Smith. I'd never heard of The Fresh Prince. But it was just one of those weird intersections of me and pop culture that worked out.
Well, Andy, I just want to let you know that I am going to put this copy that's in my hand in my bathroom tonight. And all of our bathroom guests will be able to enjoy it as I have.
Excellent.
That's Andy Borowitz. He's a writer and comedian and the editor of the new book, The 50 Funniest American Writers, an anthology of humor from Mark Twain to The Onion. Andy, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you, Guy.
Today, we're introducing NPR's Backseat Book Club. It's a special segment for all the young folks out there who listen to our program along with their parents in cars or at the kitchen table. Every month, we're offering a special conversation with authors who write books for kids. First up, a ghoulish Halloween treat called The Graveyard Book from the best-selling award-winning author Neil Gaiman. He's a master of the macabre.
I love ghoulies and ghosties and long-legged beasties and things that go bump in the night. I think these things are wonderful, but I'm not a huge fan of horror. I'll tend to use horror as a condiment in the way that you might add salt or ketchup.
And yet Gaiman uses horror to grab the reader from the very first page.
It begins, "There was a hand in the darkness and it held a knife."
Knife. A knife held by a man who snuck into an English home and killed an entire family, except for a baby who had wandered from his crib. Heavy stuff, but Gaiman was convinced kids could handle it.
I was. But I also wanted to make it very, very scary up front, because it's never that scary again.
But it is spooky and quirky, and yes, heartwarming. The young boy who escapes the knife toddles his way into a graveyard where he winds up being raised by ghosts. We asked for your questions about Neil Gaiman's The Graveyard Book, and boy, did our inbox fill up. Many of you just had to know how he conjured up such a story.
25 years ago now, I lived in a very tall, spindly building which had no kind of yard or garden. But it was just across the lane from a little country churchyard. And my son, who was about 2 years old at that point, loved his little tricycle more than anything in the world. And he couldn't really ride his tricycle around the house because the house was mostly stairs. So each day I'd take him across the lane and he would just pedal his tricycle happily and run around in a little country graveyard where, you know, you had stones going back 800 years. And I remember just one day thinking, he looks so comfortable here. And it was as if a little door opened in my head, because I thought, you know, I could do a story about a kid who is raised in a graveyard, who lives in a graveyard. And then I thought it would be like The Jungle Book. In The Jungle Book, you have a child who wanders into the jungle, is raised by wild animals, is taught all the things that wild animals know. Here I'd have a story about somebody raised by dead people and taught all the things that dead people know. And I'll call it The Graveyard Book.
Hi, Mr. Gaiman. I'm a really big fan of Coraline and The Graveyard Book. They're some of my all-time favorites. My name is Amelia Heron. I'm from Manchester, Michigan, and I'm 12 years old. And I have a question. How would you describe The Graveyard Book to someone who has never heard of it before, being the author?
Good question, Amelia. The Graveyard Book is 8 short stories, each one taking place about 2 years after the one before, that comprise the first 16 years of a young man who we come to know as Nobody Owens, and his friends call him Bod. Before the story starts, his family are killed, and he takes refuge in a graveyard. He's brought up in the graveyard, learns the things that dead people know, but also learns the value of life. And in many ways, for me, The Graveyard Book was a book about life, because you can talk about life and community and family in ways you might not have seen them described before.
Hi, my name is Anna Jaffe from Cleveland, Ohio.
Hi, my name is Sadie Begam from Cleveland, Ohio.
The Graveyard Book is fantastic.
Who is your favorite character? Ours is Silas.
It would be awesome if you could make a movie version of the book.
Bye for now, and keep writing. Love, Sadie and Anna.
Several exclamation points there.
I love Silas, writing Silas, who's not really alive and isn't really part of the graveyard was enormously fun for me. I think my favorite of the minor characters was probably a poet named Nehemiah Trott, just because writing his language was so much fun for me.
Oh, I had my revenge, Master Owens, and it was a terrible one. I wrote and had published a letter, which I nailed to the doors of the public houses in London, where such low scribbling folk were wont to frequent. And I explained that, given the fragility of the genius poetical, I would henceforth write not for them, but only for myself and posterity, and that I should, as long as I lived, publish no more poems for them.
That was Nehemiah Trott, a poet from the 1700s. He's among the dead who help raise the little boy who lives in the graveyard. Lindsay Flemons wants to know, how old is the Indigo Man?
Great question, Lindsay. I'd say the Indigo Man is probably, he's definitely very, very much the oldest thing in the graveyard, probably 10, 12,000 years old. He was there before they were building Stonehenge.
This is coming in from Michael Curtis. He writes in the middle of the day, so he explains that his fifth grade class is reading the book, and that's why he's on the computer when he is and when he should be in the classroom. And he wants to know how you came up with the ideas for the odd names of the characters in your story. And the characters really do have wonderful names. Many of them just march across the tongue.
Truthfully, a lot of the best names in the book I actually got from headstones. Because one of the things I tended to do while I was writing and researching the graveyard book is I would go to graveyards. And every now and then, if I saw something on a headstone, a really good little epitaph or something, I would write it down.
A lot of our readers gave the graveyard book a thumbs up. So did the American Library Association. Back in 2009, it gave Neil Gaiman the Newbery Medal. And in his acceptance speech, he said that children's literature is the most important fiction of all because...
I think it has the capacity to change people, to open their eyes. It's part of the growing process. I love the fact that these days with Coraline, I get adult women coming up to me who read Coraline when they were girls, saying that because she was brave, there were points in their life where they were brave, like her, and they told themselves that they could be like her. And that got them through a hard part of their life. And I feel like I did something that I didn't mean to do, but that was big and important and changed things.
Neil Gaiman, it was a pleasure to talk to you. Thank you very much.
Oh, thank you, Michelle.
That was Neil Gaiman. We were talking to him about The Graveyard Book. And a huge thank you to all of NPR's Backseat Book Club members who wrote in with questions. To read more questions and Neil Gaiman's answers, head to npr.org. A special thank you to teachers who got their classes to read the book and to email smart questions. Mr. Hastings' class, Ms. Martin's sixth grade class, and Ms. Hathaway's fifth grade class, and also Ms. Cackley's third grade class. And now, book club members, a drum roll, please. Our book for November is The Phantom Toll Booth, written by Norton Juster and illustrated by Jules Pfeiffer. Happy reading, and remember to write to Backseat Book Club at npr.org with those questions.